Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
See, I was thinking, once all this is over and Will's back and you're not a secret anymore, my parents can get you an actual bed for the basement. Or you can take my room if you want, since I'm down there all the time anyways. My point is, they'll take care of you. They'll be like your new parents, and Nancy, she'll be like your new sister.
Will you be like my brother?
What? No. No.
Hopper and Joyce are taken prisoner by Dr. Brenner at Hawkins' lab and interrogated and tortured. Before they are disposed of, Hopper cuts a deal, lets him and Joyce try to rescue Will. If they succeed, everyone walks away and pretends none of this happens in exchange for Elle's location.
Nancy and Jonathan manage to trap and wound the Demogorgon with an assist from a newly remorseful Steve, while Hopper and Joyce visit the Upside Down, where Hopper confronts his unresolved feelings about the death of his daughter and Joyce finds and rescues Will.
Dr. Brenner and his team of goons descend upon the school where the boys and Elle are hiding, while the bloodshed and violence attract a wounded Demogorgon, who makes quick work of Brenner and a security team. Elle manages to destroy the Demogorgon in a shocking display of her power and is apparently killed in the process.
Life in Hawkins quickly seems to return to normal just in time for Christmas, except Will is throwing up slug-like creatures and Hopper makes lonely visits into the freezing woods, leaving food and egos behind, for someone or something. Welcome to Dungeons & Demogorgons, the officially unofficial podcast for Stranger Things on Netflix. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we just watched Season 1, Episode 8, titled Chapter 8, The Upside Down. This is the season finale, and I gotta say, I thought it was a really, really good one, with maybe some minor exceptions.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was... It had a lot bigger of a budget feel than I was expecting.
Okay.
It had a really awesome, amazing climax. I wasn't expecting the extended kind of denouement that we got, too. Which I actually appreciated, the epilogue, where it raised a few more questions and kind of also – it did two things. It returned us to a normalcy but also set up some things that presumably will be addressed in season two.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing is I don't think they knew if they were getting a season two when this thing was filmed and aired.
Right.
So it's interesting to see them sort of kicking open those sequel doors in a way that, every single Halloween or A Nightmare on Elm Street or whatever Jason movie you're talking about does in the 80s. Like, they always have Freddy's hand come through a wall or something after you think he's dead.
Well, the thing is,
they're doing the same thing here, but it kind of surprised me because I don't know. I guess it works even if they don't get a season two, right?
Right. I was about to say, because I feel like some people, sequels are greenlit at such an alarming rate now that we've forgotten the idea of a remnant of the monster. The monster maybe not fully defeated is to leave you with that creepy feeling. It's not necessarily to set up a sequel.
That's true.
It gives you you get the emotional release of the heroes vanquishing the villain, but also when you go home, you might want to check underneath your bed because it might not be dead. So I felt like it, like you said, I think it works both ways. And obviously, we're getting a sequel, so that's all moot. We're gonna get to the bottom of this goddamn slug throwing up gate and Will's bathroom gate and Ego gate. All these scandals. Rocking Hawkins will be addressed, presumably.
Rockin' Hawkins. That should be our
Rockin' Hawkins.
The name of our podcast.
Oh, shit,
man.
It's not too late. We haven't released any of these.
Rockin' Hawkins.
It's interesting because So do you want to talk about the good stuff, or do you want to talk about the one problem I have? Because I'm not even sure if it's a problem. It's more like...
Okay, yeah, let's... I guess let's start there with the caveat that we both really like this episode.
Yeah.
So don't tune out when you go, oh, God, they're going to talk negative.
Yeah, I want to address this real quick. Because, I remember when... I mean, obviously, I watched this season, but I could not remember how Joyce and Hopper get out of Hawkins' lab because it seems like it's checkmate, game over. Like, they got the syringe out, they're going to kill him. Uh-huh. And I remember being excited when we did this episode, or this episode 7 earlier. It's like, wow, how are they going to do it? This is going to be exciting. And Hopper says, look, you let us go and try to find Will, we'll give you Elle's location.
Mm-hmm.
And this Brenner agrees. And I think from Brenner's side, we're supposed to understand that he doesn't expect them. Like, trained soldiers have gone
with
in
weapons.
There with weapons and have been torn apart by this Demogorgon.
Yep.
This fat local yokel and his crazy, grief-stricken mother are going to get torn to shreds. I don't have to worry about all this, and now I've got L.
Yeah.
The part that bothers me is, what was Hopper doing from his point of view?
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, they find Will. Do you expect them to just leave? Do you really expect them to live up to their end of the bargain? And you've also given up Elle and all the children.
That's the thing. It makes me think.
It seems
that,
like, it's a very selfish and stupid move on Hopper. I get the Brenner part, but the Hopper part, like, what? I guess you live to fight another day. And
yeah, the Hopper part is, I'm just going to sell Elle down the river. I'm going to rat her out, get the location. They're going to recapture her, and we're never going to speak of this. And the kids will be okay, I trust.
Maybe I'm going to go to the press. As soon as they get what they want, I just feel like, I don't know. There's no way for me to square. I guess it's desperation because they had the injection right there.
Yeah.
Like, if he doesn't tell them something, then he's going to die, and then it all ends, and it's like, you know, you gotta fight until you can't no more. But
yeah, and I kind of like that they break Hopper instead of breaking Joyce.
Yeah.
I think there's a tendency to say, okay, the mother here is going to be the weak link, right? Mm-hmm. She cares so much about Will that she's willing to do anything. But it's interesting how they compare, I guess, Will's situation with his daughter's situation. Hopper's dead daughter's situation with cancer.
Yeah,
He identifies so much with the struggle that Joyce is going through right now.
Yes.
And knows that he can do something about it if he's willing to give up, I guess, Elle, which he has far less concern for than Will.
Yeah. And again, if he doesn't, then it's all over, and they'll probably without... I mean, he's thinking, like, what are their percentages without me and Joyce? What are these kids going to do?
Yeah.
It's not bad, but it is a little hand-wavy, and just ignore that rough patch so we can get on with the rest of the finale, which I'm fine with.
A little
with.
Bit, yeah.
I just, you know...
And the idea that a government agency like this would feel the need to spare them, whereas they could just inject him, kill Joyce, and be done with it.
Yeah, like, oh, you gave me what we want from L, so... And that's like they do address that because the evil social worker, as they're walking out of facility, kind of questions, like, what the fuck are you doing? Why don't we just liquidate him? And he's like, oh, they won't make it out. And like,
yeah, I guess.
Okay, so now you're Goldfinger. Oh, I expect you to die, Mr. Hopper. Well, he's not. He's going to wiggle out his laser thing and come fuck you.
Well, I like how they play that to where it makes sense. So, like, I think they would have died if they had gone in there. And circumstances had been different on the outside, they probably would have gotten killed by the Demogorgon. But the way things work out, the Demogorgon is being drawn away by several powerful motivators.
Yes.
Nancy and Jonathan draw them away long enough for them to get in there, start looking around, and then the Demogorgon's drawn to the chaos at the high school, the blood at the high school, which essentially frees up Joyce and Hopper to do whatever they want in there.
Yeah, like, I think that's what makes it work, because the self-sacrifice and the pluckiness of the older children give them just enough breathing room, and then Dr. Brenner's greed, lying, and violence does the rest.
Yeah.
So, like I said, it's not great, but I think it works in context, and hopefully they can kind of clean some of this stuff up going into season two.
Yeah.
The other things I want to talk about is, I really like the idea. I really like some of the visuals they did here. Like, they started off with the camera just taking in the inky black void of space.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last, before we skip to the epilogue with the Christmas time, is it pans up to the same scene.
Yeah.
Is that just a really beautiful shot, like a True Detective style look at the lights winning, or is it supposed to suggest some kind of extraterrestrial connection to the Demogorgons?
I don't know. I've never thought of this as an extraterrestrial. It's an extra universal sort of thing, right?
Right.
An extra dimensional thing.
But it wasn't clear. Like, it was a definite creative choice. I wasn't sure if it's a symbolic one as well.
I'm not sure. But I did enjoy the visual, certainly.
Mm-hmm. And it did capture kind of like, you know, the majesty of dark skies and kind of rural United States.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
So after this all goes off, there's a lot of stuff I want to talk about, but sticking with Hopper for a minute, it's like, okay, at the end of this, he comes out of this, Dr. Brenner's dead, pretty much everybody in that lab is dead, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he's at the Christmas party, and when he leaves, or no, the hospital, when he leaves the hospital where Will has been taken,
mm-hmm.
a black car rolls up, and a couple guys get out, they open the door for him, and he gets in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never really mentioned again. Next time we see him, he's at a Christmas party a month later. And apparently, like, everything's cool with him and the government. Like, was that just we're going to take you in and see if you really have anything to say? Like, are you going to talk here? This is intimidation. Don't talk. What is it?
That's the Bureau of Paranormal Defense recruiting him for Hellboy 3.
You think so?
Yeah. That's exactly what's happening. Yeah. Just come with us. It's going to take a long time to get you in that red makeup. Better start now. We might be ready in a year's time from now.
Yeah.
I think that's what it is. But I wonder...
That felt like a loose end to me. But I think they're trying to say something. I just don't know what
it is. No, I think that my idea is kind of like yours, that I think that he's going to be co-opted by this. Like, wait, look, you know too much, but you're also strangely capable, so we're going to bring you on the inside of what we're trying to do here.
Hmm. Like, is that why he's leaving Egos for Elle?
Could bring
her back somehow.
But it could be also that he's we don't know, because I my first thought was like, well, once we see the thing pick him up, well, that's it. But then we saw him just like back at the police agency as if it's nothing. So I wonder if he's trying, they're suggesting that he's working with them, but the ego thing shows that he's kind of working against them.
Hmm.
Because that implies that he knows something about the whereabouts of Elle.
Yeah.
And he's doing something on his own time. It's like, you know, this isn't something that the research scientist and the lab and who else is of the government. Like, it seems like everyone died.
Everyone we were familiar with.
Now, I'm sure they have files on him. They can follow this stuff up. But what do they actually know about him? And so much of the stuff that they know about him came out that night. So there's a big question mark, but a lot of really cool potential ideas they could run with.
Yep.
Because I had this idea of, like, it would be kind of cool if he's secretly working for Hawking's lab, but he's still maintaining his relationships in town, and, like, what kind of betrayal, like, if there's a chance for some sort of betrayal between, like, him and Joyce. Because the other thing is, I thought that they would hint that maybe him and Joyce were together.
Didn't seem like it.
Which, that's fine. That's actually, you know, I tend to enjoy when they resist doing the matchy match stuff.
A little cliche, yeah.
Right. Like, it's one thing, like, if you're going to introduce a relationship, then that should be a big plot component.
They really resist it, too, because I would have suspected Jonathan and Nancy would have got together after this whole life and death situation. But they don't. Steve's still in the mix.
Nancy and Steve.
I was surprised by that, but at the same time, I'm kind of like, okay.
Also, the way they played it is like maybe Nancy herself is conflicted because, you know, Steve's back and he's dreamy, he's got the hair and he's remorseful.
In the BMW.
But, you know, but Jonathan, you know, she gives him a kiss, which isn't nothing.
Yeah, no, that's true.
Get the spray paint out. Fucking Nancy Wheeler, just spray paint. Like, you're kissing another boy.
Yeah, next season 2, episode 1,
right.
Steve's spray painting.
He hasn't learned a goddamn thing.
No. I really like that moment where they give him the camera back, though.
Yeah.
Because you can tell Steve was involved, too. He feels bad about it. The transformation that guy went through over the course of this season, wow.
Yeah.
At least my perception of him. I don't know that he was ever that bad a guy. It's just like he came off as really douchey.
That's where, like, because I remember it being like a hairpin turn that he made. And then, you know, you can kind of tell in my coverage of this season on the rewatch, I was like, What evidence do I have that Steve is really a creep?
Nothing. Like nothing. It's all just image.
Like, he's kind of a playboy, but there's nothing wrong with that, and he's not really being.
But we don't like ever see him with any other girls. Right. He's always with Nancy. Like, he breaks Jonathan's camera, yes, but Jonathan deserved it.
Yeah,
I think.
Right. In fact, that's the one thing. Like, I still made a stink face when they gave him the camera back. It's like, so we're just cool with that, huh? Like, it was never really dealt with to my satisfaction. And
yeah,
also,
I guess the explanation wasn't
the very first time that his friends really got out of line with the spray painting. Like, he instantly kind of made a break.
Yeah, yeah, he did.
You know, I mean, Jonathan did beat the piss out of him, so that's probably a little bit of a formative experience.
Yeah.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make. Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time. Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers. Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited. It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live. Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday. Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and we'll find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Speaking of the artistic flourishes, I really liked how when they first established Joyce and Hopper being in the Upside Down, that the camera literally is upside down.
Yeah,
and
cool.
Slowly rotates to the correct perspective, like selling us on the idea of how this dimension stuff works, which
I
thought.
It's such a simple thing,
but
it's very effective.
It's super cool. And I really like the arc of Hopper having to deal, like Joyce is facing her own demon, which is the potential loss of her son, and she's too late, and no one took her seriously. But Hopper is like dealing with all these unresolved issues about how he felt as a parent, and
the helplessness,
of seeing your child waste away, and how they sold that, and they showed when they pulled the tube out of Will, like they're doing the thing with his daughter and, mm-hmm. and the CPR versus him giving Will. I was like, God damn, he's cracking every one of Will's ribs.
Right. Just pounding away.
Will's ribs are just going to be a loose assembly of gravel by the time Hopper's done with it, because he's not going to lose his goddamn patient. But it was really effective. And I felt like, you know, when I saw the runtime, because I was like, well, maybe this is like a 90-minute episode. But when they're hitting, it's like, oh, this is going to be too little, too late character development. But I thought it really flowed nicely. And it added a whole other depth and vulnerability to Hopper that didn't really exist before.
No, it came out of nowhere, sort of. You know, there were light hints at something with his daughter. Mm-hmm. We knew that he had lost a daughter, but that was about it. And light hints that it bothered him still. But, like, you're right. It could have been this crazy race car development that we didn't expect and didn't care about, but
or it could
somehow
have been,
they nailed it.
Here's the thing: like The Walking Dead does this. Hopper, they play. Barry McCreary plays some light piano, sad minor chord music,
uh-huh.
and Hopper stares off into the middle distance as the camera slowly pulls in his face, and he tells us
uh-huh.
for 2 minutes how he lost his daughter. This where, like, every single step of the adventure was another wound that ripped open in his psyche.
Yeah.
I mean, it's showing versus telling, right?
Yep.
One is hack, one is art.
Yeah, and Hopper never opened his mouth and said, I miss my daughter. Like,
no.
I feel powerless right now.
But,
like, none of that.
But all of the – and the flashbacks also didn't stay too long. It was – they never derailed the thing. It was like a 5 or 10 seconds of, like, oh, this is Hopper in her better days, and oh, shit, something's going horribly wrong. And bam, you're right back in the upside down.
Yeah.
And that just – that's a hell of a job constructing and editing and making us feel something in less than, like, 50 minutes. 50 minutes of story time. I was really impressed that they managed to get away with that.
Yeah, me too.
Do you think the Demogorgon is a singular entity? And how in the fuck does bear trapping it, shooting it 100 times, lighting mm-hmm. it on fire? I mean, it was clearly getting fucked up.
Yeah.
Like it was severely burnt in the final scenes, but it lost none of its potency or effectiveness.
Yeah, it
and
makes
Elle
me
essentially dissolved it from the inside out with her power.
Yeah, I felt like the only way to kill it.
That's scary.
Right?
It's
I
like
mean,
it's
you
like,
want the monster to be scary.
It makes me think, like, is you know, Alien was a movie about a singular alien eviscerating an entire crew on a starship.
Mm-hmm.
Aliens just did that, only now it's like, what if there's 100 of them?
Uh-huh.
Or maybe hundreds of them, and throw a marine platoon at them. What do you think?
Oh, if there are hundreds of Demogorgons in season 2?
Yeah, what do you think? I mean, there's clearly they did some kind of X-Files shit with Will where they had that esophageal tube stuck down his throat and now he's barfing up slugs. Do you think this is the first time it's happened to him? Do you think he's barfed several slugs into the water system of
Hawkins? He recovers awfully quickly from it. He's just like, he's able to walk back to the table and pretend to be okay to his family's satisfaction. So
did that...
Yeah, probably. This is not the first time that's happened to him.
Did that instant flash into the upside down, did that really happen? Is that to suggest that he's getting like L-like powers? Is that just his trauma from puking up the weird slug?
I don't know. I think these are all questions that will probably be addressed in season 2. And that's the interesting thing, I guess, if you want to say Hopper is maybe working on the inside of this operation, the Department of Energy's operation now,
mm-hmm.
He might have access, like, let's say there are 100 Demogorgons or whatever.
Yeah.
He might actually have access to some part of MKUltra that he can harness to fight them, to defeat them. Like, if there were a whole bunch of Ls, right?
Oh, right.
He could do the same thing that L did to all the Demogorgons.
Sure.
But I don't know if that exists. Hopper might, though.
What did you think about the relationship development between Mike and L? I thought the themes of Friends Don't Lie, with him trying to dissemble about his true feelings about her and her kind of, like, you know, open delight at the idea that she'd be taken to a dance and him kissing her.
Yeah.
I thought that was the whole, like, he's analogous. It's like, oh, you can come with us and everybody, like, you know, mom will be your mom and dad will be your dad and my sister will be your sister and you'll be like my brother. No.
Yeah.
I thought that was all sweet. And then the fact that it gets kind of ripped away from him, you know, a lot of little boy feels here.
Yeah, no, I think the end of the episode, or the climax, I guess, where L disappears,
mm-hmm.
is very effective, very affecting, I would say.
Yeah.
Certainly on me. Like, I felt for Mike in that situation.
And it's like they sell the last scenes, and it's all on Christmas, which I'm a sucker for Christmas. And, you know, everything's like the families are back together, and the kids are playing D&D, and everyone's safe and happy and warm. But it's very hard to feel really good about it because Elle, central character that we all grew to care about, is dead or missing.
Yeah.
Or locked away in the Upside Down, or she's ascended to the spectral plane. I don't know.
And I'm glad that they let us know Mike isn't totally over that, because during the D&D game, he very much seemed like it.
Right.
But he's still thinking about it.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder, like, should we be looking for Elle to come back in season two? My guess is yes, but yeah. I really don't know.
I want to know what kind of Candyland campaigns Mike is running that, like, a fucking level one wizard spell can destroy the boss of every encounter. Like,
yeah, well, it's only a 10-hour campaign, I guess.
If fucking Will had just thrown the fireball in the get-go, none of this would have ever happened. The Demogorgon would have died. Like, the Hydralisk is all everything has. The biggest bad in Mike's campaign has about 16 hit points.
Yep.
And zero armor class.
Yeah, I praised Mike for being the world's greatest DM at the beginning of this show.
Yeah.
Now I'm not so sure. Mike's running 10-hour campaigns with level one bosses.
I think he's got one crutch, which is his epic death scenes that he plays for these boss characters. And does that and the kids
and the surprise of the final monster, right?
Well, it makes...
Although Dustin calls it every time.
You know, I noticed that, like, with my son, is when he hits on something that is, like, funny or cool or exciting, like, he runs it into the fucking ground. Because it's like he discovered uranium, and he wants to see how many different ways he can split that up. And so, I mean, it is kind of realistic, but it's like, I don't know. 10 hours, too short. it's the same damn thing.
I hope that's not... foreshadowing of season two and how it's going to play out.
I don't know.
With the,
I'm kind of interested to see what they do, because these kids presumably are going to be a year older, and like, are they still going to be hanging around and playing D&D? Or is
going to be like what 13?
They're going to be 13, and I'd like to see, because that's more the age where like the friends group stops becoming the kids you hung out at neighborhoods or your homeroom, and they start to like form. Like, my son was like, I dropped him off at, because he had a dentist appointment bidet, and a bidet. He has a dentist appointment in the bidet. He has a dentist appointment, and once a week he attends the STEM classes at the high school. So I dropped him off, and he's like, man, high school is really different from elementary school. And I'm like, oh, really? He's like, yeah, there's like gangs. Like, you gotta decide what gang you want to roll with. And I'm like, god damn, yeah, it's interesting that you're perceiving all this.
Yeah.
But I wonder if they'll deal with any of that. Like, maybe who's the guy who's gonna big time the others? Like, I think it's gonna be Lucas or Mike. Lucas or Mike is gonna decide that they're too cool to be with the other guy. The other guy's like, Dustin's dragging him down, or fucking Will's too weird, and I want to be cool now, and I can't be seen with you guys.
Yeah. I think it'll be weird. I think it'll be Will being weird, because he's got the stigma, right? The weird kid who was taken. And
yeah, and he's throwing up slugs.
Yeah, he's acting weird. Like,
he was gone for like a whole fucking... Well, he wasn't gone for very long.
Where was he? There are going to be rumors around the school of where he went.
Yeah, how long was he actually gone? Like,
a few days, I think.
Yeah, because like he... almost enough to thirst to death.
Yeah.
To die. What do you call that when you die of...
Dehydrate?
Die of dehydration, yeah.
Yeah.
You die of thirst. Almost enough to die of thirst, but not quite.
Yeah.
To die of exposure and thirst. But, yeah, I mean, that's like... And there's like clip arts of like, oh, the kid that was dead, he's back to life. Like, it's... That's going to be... I don't know. Maybe this
also,
is...
Also, he's got Jonathan for a brother, so...
Right. Do you think that... The other thing is, I guess, that... I guess I would like to see them explore that, because I think that's really cool, and it's a very young adult thing to explore. But maybe this season's not the right one. I've heard that this is essentially a 4-season arc.
Yeah, so that's what I've heard too.
I mean, it also wouldn't hurt my feelings if they all just stayed bros for life. You know, that would be kind of sweet too. But I would like to see a little bit of attention within the group.
Okay. Yeah, I can get down with that.
I probably should have saved some of this for the preview podcast.
Well, but it was interesting because the stuff that was tense among the kids in this season is Elle, right? Like she's the core of their – she's the wedge, I guess, into the group here. She's gone. She's out of the picture. So what would bring about that tension, I guess?
I don't know. Like I said, social change, because it happens. Yeah. Like
what grade were they in? Do you remember? Were they about to go into high school, or were they about to...
Maybe they're in middle school.
Got another year of middle school, maybe?
I think they were 12 years old, which would mean they were in sixth grade.
Hmm. Okay.
So
then they're about to go into middle school.
Well, but I mean, this because like my son, like they go middle school is sixth through eighth.
Yeah.
Like when I was a kid, seventh through eighth was middle school. Yeah. So, and that's about when all that starts.
Okay.
I also thought it was cool that like Lucas's wrist rocket kind of paid off.
Sort of, but not in the way I expected. I wanted him to shoot the monster killer. The rock.
Yeah.
And I never saw him shoot that rock.
Oh, see, I think we're supposed to understand that the one that he slow-mo'd, that was the monster killer, but this realization that wouldn't have worked with that L's power.
Right, which was awesome. I thought it was his surprise when he hits the monster and it actually does something.
Yeah. And I thought, I was ready to believe that with its mouth open, there's some kind of weak point where it's soft skull that he can just... You know, do a David versus Goliath. But then when L came through with a head of steam, that was badass. Like, L exploding their brains and blood, like, that was so disturbing and disgusting, but cool. Mm-hmm. And her just going Super Saiyan at the end. I don't know why she had to fling Mike like a ragdoll.
She threw Mike
like Lucas. You know, she Lucas'd him. I don't understand why she had to do that, but that was... That was really fucking cool.
No, it's awesome that, you know, this is very much like a Goonies or an E.T. or any of those other movies from the 80s that we've talked about where the kids are the center of it and they're like the adventurers. But it has this adult twist to it where in E.T. or the Goonies, you would never see the kids murder people, right?
Right.
Whereas L comes in and all of a sudden people's heads are melting.
Yeah.
That to me is like the big difference that makes this appropriate for me as a 35-year-old man.
Yeah.
As opposed to just like another Goonies remake.
Right.
Because that would be fun and nostalgic, but it wouldn't have that weight to it that this does.
You're right. You would engage with it as a form of nostalgia.
Yeah.
Not as like, oh, I'm an adult and I'm actually enjoying this adult take on the same material.
Yeah, it's very much more real. Like, things get messy, people die, it's the real world. Like, your problems aren't solved by some miraculous solution that the kids can get away without harming anybody.
I love the scene of the kids in the hospital and Lucas and Dustin are like asleep on top of each other, just racked out.
Yeah.
I like the Lord of the Rings style, like everybody swamping Frodo on his bed and Riverdale.
Yeah.
Everybody's like excitingly. And from Will's perspective, he's been in this like he's had this terrifying experience, and the guys seem like they were living it up as kings.
Yeah,
that is superpowered girl. There's melting brains, and like, how much of that stuff do you fucking believe? And how much? I mean, it's weird. I was thinking, like, as a 12-year-old, how do you go back to D&D when you've lived this experience?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it just makes your imagination more vivid.
It's like are there combat veterans that come back and play paintball?
Huh.
I mean, maybe there are.
Probably they exist.
Maybe there are, but it's weird to role play something that you live through even more like horrifying and vivid.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, kids are resilient, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to start feeling bad for Will if season two comes around and he's the kid who's missing out on the adventure again. Like, he had his own adventure, but it was far more terrifying.
That's the thing, because I remember I joke, last year's Baldies, we were debating giving the award to, like, all the kids, and I joked, like, no, Will doesn't get one. Will doesn't get 5 minutes in the beginning and the finale. And the truth is, he actually had a lot more involvement than I thought, but still, he definitely got the short end of the camera stick, and I hope that they don't sideline him for the whole other... Actually, I hope they don't sideline any of these kids.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they're all great.
Yeah.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Speaking of the short end of the camera stick, what is it? Okay, so this kid goes through this traumatic experience. He goes to the Upside Down. He comes back. He survives the Demogorgon, and suddenly he gets to open everybody's fucking Christmas presents.
Why is
Jonathan letting Will open his Christmas present? Who? This could be anything. This could be her confession of love to him, and he's going to let his little brother open it.
Yeah, I thought that was a little like, man, your imagination is lacking, Jonathan.
Yeah.
It's like nothing about your... Yeah, I thought so too. And I was also making... Because me and Cecily watched this together. We've watched all the others in the office, but she... Our schedule's crazy enough. We were watching it together, and I made a joke. It's like, oh, I get it. It's the box that he puts his dick in. That was before I found out that she was with Steve and all that, but she's like, like he just won't take a hint. Uh-huh. Like, she's been trying to get with him, and it's Christmas time, and she's finally like, here, step one, cut the hole in the box.
Yep.
But, yeah, it turns out it says camera. And Will gets an Atari.
Yeah.
The days before
you
Nintendo,
should not
that
ask
was the
for
Cadillac.
The new Atari, though. Don't ask for the new Atari. Ask for the old Atari, because the new Atari sucks.
I don't know, man. I like the 7200.
Yeah?
I lusted after the
Was it the 72 or was that the 50?
There's the 56 and then the 72.
The 56 was a piece of shit.
The
controllers were terrible. They broke all the time.
Okay, that might be true. But I went through a lot of Atari 2600 controllers, too.
Yeah.
And then it's like, what, in 85, 86, the Nintendo came out?
Yeah.
Like, it's in... insane how short the domination of Atari was.
Yeah, it's like 78 to 84, essentially.
Right, and done. Yeah. The only place they still live is in the Blade Runner movies.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the final scene of the kind of like, you know, they've already had the kind of heartwarming stuff, and then they dipped into Hopper leaving the box with Eggos, and then they showed the, you know, Briar's Christmas and Will throwing up slugs and his terrifying encounter with the Upside Down in the bathroom. But the last scene we see is this essentially Norman Rockwell painting of, you know, middle America and Christmas time as they come out the window and you see them eating their terrible Christmas dinner.
Yeah.
Joyce might be many things, but Christ. Yeah, that's like liquefied mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
Ooh, boy.
I can tolerate lumps. Sometimes I even like lumps.
Yeah,
but they got to be thick.
Err on the side of too firm.
Yeah.
Than too runny. And also, like, did you run out of flakes? Put the fucking flakes. Just don't. You can fix this problem.
You can, yeah.
Like, it's a ratio. If you fuck it up, you just put in more flakes, you know? Like, yeah. Come on, Joyce. You just didn't care. You just didn't care. Donald over at the Five and Dime has been giving you shit ever since he advanced you two paychecks, and it's been tough over there, but still, add a couple more. It takes you 30 seconds to add some more flakes. Come on.
Flakes are coming out of your check, Joyce. Double cost for you.
Maybe she did. She's like, she's made a five-gallon bucket full of potatoes, and she just vacillated between too much milk, too much flakes, and she finally ran out of flakes. Like, well, this is as good as it gets.
Yeah.
So what are you going to do? Boil the mashed potatoes until you,
I guess, yeah,
render it down.
Sure.
Yeah, solvable. You just didn't care, Joyce.
Yep.
Didn't care. You didn't care to give your recently de-Demogorgon child a good Christmas dinner.
Yeah,
this is why he's got a leech inside of him.
I survived the fucking Demogorgon. I come back to these potatoes.
That's right. You give him some decent potatoes to stick to his ribs. That leech will have nothing to cling to in there.
The hospital had better mashed potatoes, Mom. The fucking hospital. Send me back there for Christmas.
God, what was the main course like? What was her fucking stove like?
The dog ate half of it.
That's true. That's true. And also, that dog would not have stopped at the slices.
No.
He would have gone for the whole fucking thing.
That was,
and he would have gotten it too.
That was a trained acting dog.
Mm-hmm. 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 I think that's about all we've got to talk about.
I did want to say that Steve, when he shows up at Nancy's house, this plan is excellent.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
This is the other thing that bugs me. Okay.
This whole plan is excellent, I think. Steve shows up at the exact moment to save his future relationship with Nancy.
Sure.
Right before Jonathan and Nancy kiss, because I think it's all over for him.
Yeah.
If that happens.
Yeah.
And then he pulls the Joyce.
It's Marty McFly and Back to the Future.
Oh,
kisses
yeah.
Are there,
yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, all of a sudden,
he saw his picture disappearing and he was like, oh shit, I gotta get in there. so he comes in and I'm thinking like, okay, he's gonna pull a Joyce here. I was thinking, okay, he's running away, but then he pulls a Joyce and he goes back into the house. And I thought that was a pretty good move by Steve.
Pretty good move by Steve. It bothered me a little bit that he was able to essentially steal the hero spotlight from Jonathan. Because like Jonathan had
or
been,
even from Nancy. Like
she
was also out there with the bat and the gun, like
right.
He ends up
and he
in
was
kind of
badass.
Of
he out badassed them both, which I didn't like. I think it was fine for him to be brave, but it should have been like on the margins of bravery, not like him going in there like Joaquin Phoenix in the end of Signs and just fucking swinging away Meryl. Like I didn't like how competent he was when he decided like he's going to be competent.
It was a little much for me, but
yeah, it stole the show from Jonathan a little bit. Now Jonathan's still he's just a creep at the camera.
Yeah, that's why he won Nancy, I guess.
He didn't though. Oh, Steve did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a shocker. When I saw her curl up was because she gave him that present and that kiss. I'm like, okay, well, this is they're telling us. And also she gave him a look.
Yeah.
And like she was kind of dressing more like she wasn't dressed. She was kind of dressing the way I think Nancy likes to dress. And I felt like, okay, this is the story of she's not trying to go too fast. She's not trying to be something she's not.
Right.
This is her accepting who she is. And then she goes, curls up with Steve. Maybe he's met her halfway. Like I don't know, but like maybe we're gonna have a love triangle. In season two.
We might. I do think their plan was good though, and trapping the Demogorgon in the bear trap and then lighting it on fire.
Oh, when you see it, how they all did it like that.
Yeah.
That kind of like getting ready montage was really cool.
Making the bat with nails
They light it and you could clearly see, okay, this is what they're trying to do and this is how they're going to do it, and I like it.
But I don't know.
I
still think the fire extinguisher is a mistake. I would burn that house to the fucking foundation before
totally,
I put it out, that fire.
Totally, dude. I've got that in my in my notes. Like, why let the... This is not a great house.
No.
Your mom's already put a giant hole that your crazy dad just put a piece of plywood over. Burn her down.
Yes.
Burn it the fuck down.
For sure. Claim the insurance and move on with your lives.
Yeah. So, because the Demogorgon, I guess, can just... Does he have to smash through walls every time, or can he just manifest and demanifest? Because
I don't know.
It was super scary when the lights went out and it just kind of came up from the floor.
Yeah.
But, like, how the fuck did it get out of the bear trap?
We just don't know the rules.
Yeah, that's...
Of the Demogorgon.
A bit... You know, we talk about this on Game of Thrones a lot. Like, the later you go in a story with the... barest sketch of how the universe works, the more the authors of said universe are empowered to pull solutions out of their ass.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that Elle's solution to the Demogorgon worked? Do you think that by disintegrating it entirely, she has actually defeated it?
Yeah, I think the
show is trying to tell us that, but
right.
I don't know if I would be surprised if they brought it back next season.
No, I wouldn't either, or that there's something like maybe they've merged, because the effect they use is very reminiscent of like John Coffey from The Green Mile. Like whenever he would take on evil inside himself, it would always come out like this cloud of black ash or gnats. And like when she dissolved it in the light, but then it dissolved her in the darkness. And yeah. I'm wondering if there's going to be... Oh, and also, remember whenever she'd manifest her powers at the most strongest point, her skin would get all mottled and weird. Like, I wonder if they're suggesting that she has integrated, like that there's been some kind of synthesis of Elle and the Demogorgon, which is exciting and terrifying.
Yeah, I wonder if she's using some power that is derived from the Upside Down, and that the like purpling of her skin and stuff that we see is her being pulled into that dimension.
Just
when
like
she uses
when you
her
see
power.
Our dimension from the Upside Down's perspective, it looks like it's being corrupted and it's being eaten away. And like, yeah, I do.
So maybe she disappears into the Upside Down, and next season they could find out. Like Mike could get some indication that she's still alive, but she's in the Upside Down and trapped, very much like Will was.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they go after her? I don't know.
And now her face opens up like a vampire from Blade, and she's like,
kiss me,
Will. He's like, I'm not ready for that. Let's just go to the snowball and see how it goes. Your freaky deaky clawed feet and hands. Like,
yeah,
I
you're more of a sister to me at this point.
Yeah. All right. That's a great first season. If you've listened to this from the beginning, you probably already know that next week or this coming Friday is going to be our preview podcast for season 3. It's going to be a simultaneous wrap up and preview. So we're going to talk about everyone's thoughts and feelings and our own overall for season 2 or season 1, things that we're looking forward to for season 2. And then the next Friday, Stranger Things drops, all hell breaks loose at Bald Move, and we are going to marathon a series over that weekend and aim to have a podcast for every episode out before the weekend's up. And then the following week, we'll have a wrap up for season 2.
Yep.
Lots of different ways you can slice that. That's the way we've chosen to. And hope you enjoy it. I'm excited.
Me too.
It's going to be some good watching.
This is one of the most anticipated TV events of this year for me.
Yeah. I want to kind of jump into the preview podcast, because the debut of Mr. Robot season 3 has got all the, like, I remember how disappointed I was in season 2, and I'm like, there's a lot of reasons to be nervous, because you know the Duffer brothers had their entire lives essentially to come up with this,
right?
Yeah. And now they're turning around in a year's time and they're going to hit us with the sequel, and is it going to have the same magic? Is it going to be
that True Detective problem, right?
True Detective had the same kind of sophomore stumble. Lots of shows do. Or it could be like Breaking Bad, where the second stage ignition takes off and it gets even in higher heights. So who knows? But they got a great half the battles won. They got a great cast.
Fantastic cast, yeah.
Fantastic cast for kids, and they all have the chops to do it. So, like, that's half the battle. If you can just give them the right words and put them in their mouth, and, you know, then they should be successful. But we'll see. That's some stuff we'll talk about in a preview podcast.
Yep.
Thanks for listening to our Season 1 coverage of Stranger Things. If you like what you hear and want more, check out all of our television, movie, and pop culture content on baldmove.com. If you'd like to help support our podcast and get a ton of bonus content and features, check out club.baldmove.com. We'll also be taking feedback during our upcoming Season 1 wrap-up podcast, so send that in to strangerthings@baldmove.com. You can also discuss this with your fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.